The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That's gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8888. Today's issue of Time Magazine is dated March 15/March 22, 2021. As usual, it is bordered in red on the front cover. And the headline says, Women and the Pandemic. That's set in large black type on a white margin. The word Time in very large block print, capital letters, is white, superimposed on a portrait of a woman holding a child in the air. She's looking up at the child. It's in a silhouette form, so the profiles of both the adult and the child are seen through the lens of the camera. And the two individuals, or the one individual is standing and the other is being lifted into the air in front of what appears to be a stained glass or art glass window. It's arched and the colors are golden, yellow, and white. There are two forms which are recognizable in the lower panes, and that is side by side two yellow-gold crosses with white blocks of glass surrounding them. And on the top, a quarter of the arch is in white, then two quarters near the apex in the golden yellow, and another quarter on the right side in white. The caption reads, A Haven for New Moms at the Border by Jasmine Aguilera. And the additional caption reads, Xiomara, X-I-O-M-A-R-A, with her baby at San Juan Apostol, a shelter in Juarez, Mexico, for asylum-seeking pregnant women. In times of crisis, women carry the weight. Fortitude comes in many forms. This is part of the Women in Pandemic reporting, Women and the Pandemic reporting, highlighted these 2 weeks in Time magazine. Hakira Diaz wrote this several years ago when I was in my mid-20s after suffering from major depressive disorder and anxiety for most of my life. I found myself at the emergency room during an episode of substance-induced psychosis. My father and stepmother found me at the very beginning of the episode having paranoid delusions. Someone had tried to poison me, and now they were coming. I told them, do not answer the door. Somehow I listened when they said I needed to see a doctor. We'll be with you the whole time, my father said. At the hospital, after checking my vitals and asking me to describe what was wrong, the triage nurse talked to my father. He explained my history with depression, my mother's schizophrenia. I was given an emergency bed. A psychiatrist, a tall, middle-aged, blind man, approached with his guide dog. He asked questions while my father and stepmother watched, worried, nervous. When was the last time you slept? Do you ever feel disconnected from yourself or from reality? Do you hear voices? I'm not crazy, I insisted. I was afraid I was going to be hospitalized or medicated against my will, which had happened to my mother many times. The doctor reassured me, everyone here wants the best for you. Right now, we are just trying to understand. I glared at him, then at my father, who looked miserable, tears welling. My stepmother took my hand, and there was such kindness in her eyes that in that moment she seemed like an angel, and suddenly it clicked. Something happened in my brain, like a fog had lifted, and I could see clearly my stepmother was an angel. I took in all my surroundings, the hospital bed, the curtain half open, my parents waiting. The angel was there to help me cross over. I had died. They'd been keeping this from me. Am I alive? I asked my parents. Or did I die? They both burst into tears and wrapped their arms around me while I asked again and again. Am I alive? Please tell me the truth. Am I alive? I felt the heat of them on my body, their tears on my skin, and I doubted any of it was real. I pulled away and did not like what I saw in their faces. I am not crazy, I said again. I remembered my mother, who had spent so much time in mental hospitals, psychiatric wards, her whole life cycling between being over-medicated, under-medicated, ignored, treated like a hysterical woman who could not care for herself. How many times had she told me, all these doctors, and for what? They don't ever listen to me. There was movement on the other side of the curtain, nurses calling out to one another, someone wheeling a cart down the hallway. And then, out of the corner of my eye, the psychiatrist, his guide dog at his side, and another fog lifted. He was no doctor. He was a demon, come to take me to hell, along with his hellhound. I started screaming. More nurses burst through the curtain. Someone took my wrists. The psychiatrist, the nurses, everyone stopped speaking to me and spoke only to my father. Her heart is racing, someone explained, dangerously high. She could have a heart attack. Do it, my father said. He left the room as they held me down. My stepmom pulled back the curtain. It was time now. There was a needle, then an IV. The demon and his hellhound stood at the edge of the bed. Above me, the overhead lights were bright, so bright. I started Ordinary Girls, my first book, shortly after that first episode of psychosis in October 2007. I was in treatment, getting better, and working was helping me find a way back to myself, even though I was writing about surviving sexual violence, about my mother's mental illness, and about my own struggles with depression and suicidal ideation. I could not really get my head around what I was doing. I was just trying to make sense of my life. I was trying to figure out how to keep living. More than a decade later, when the book was released, I was happy for the first time. I was still struggling with anxiety and depression, but I'd never been this happy. I was engaged to the love of my life, and we shared homes in Miami Beach and Montreal. I was doing what I loved, writing and teaching. I was in the middle of my book tour, which had started as a small 10-city tour and grew into a several months-long affair with over 40 readings, speaking engagements, and lectures all over the country. Then overnight, at the start of the pandemic, everything stopped. We did not know it yet, but my fiancé and I would be separated for 5 months. I was in Miami, and because of the COVID-19 travel bans instituted by the Trump administration, they were forced to travel back home to the UK. One day I was sharing my life and work with my partner, spending time with family and friends, talking to my mother every day, traveling 3 times a week to talk about work I loved, planning our wedding, and then suddenly I was living alone, separated from my partner, from my family, from my friends. All of my remaining book tour events were canceled, so I lost most of my income for the year. We had to cancel our wedding. My partner's interview with U.S. Immigration was postponed again and again and then finally canceled. They had to remain in the U.K. until the travel bans were lifted, and then my mother got sick, spending months in the ICU in a South Miami hospital after a terrible year of recurrent pneumonia. The doctors advised us to make plans to say our goodbyes. Like so many other women have over the past year, I was struggling with almost every aspect of my life. The recession caused by the COVID-19 pandemic is disproportionately affecting women. And while women in the U.S. appear to be impacted most, this is a global problem. According to the McKinsey Global Institute, during the pandemic, women have lost their jobs at 1.8 times the rate of men. A January 2021 report by the National Women's Law Center has found that in the U.S., women's labor force participation rate is 57%, on par with the rate in 1988. Approximately 40% of women over 20 have been without work for 6 months or longer, with white women's unemployment rate at 5.1%, while Asian women saw a rate of 7.9%. Black women saw a rate of 8.5%, and Latinas saw a rate of 8.8%. And women who were forced to leave their jobs to care for their children, who are now at home because of COVID-19 school closures, are not officially counted as unemployed. A study by CARE, C-A-R-E, a nonprofit that fights global poverty, found that the pandemic has caused a crisis in women's mental health, and that accessing the quality health care services they need has been significantly harder during this time. After months in isolation, I started to experience that firsthand. I did not leave my apartment for days, weeks. Time became meaningless. I stopped sleeping, stopped eating, stopped reading and writing, stopped doing everything and anything I loved. It was not so much that I chose to stop, but that I just could not, even though I tried. I'd try melatonin one night, Benadryl the next. I'd doze off for 2-3 hours and then wake in despair. I called friends, desperate for sleep or feeling absolutely exhausted with life, or convinced that I was having a heart attack, or that we were all going to die. I did not hug another person for a month, then 2, 3, 4, 5, when I finally slept, after swallowing my last 4 sleeping pills, I did not wake for a day and a half. The day after winning an award for my book, I called a suicide prevention hotline. There is a history of mental illness on both sides of my family. We have all been in and out of therapy at some point, on and off medication. 5 of my mother's 6 siblings suffer from depression or bipolar disorder. My maternal grandmother, like my mother, spent her life battling schizophrenia and depression and threatening to end her life. 10 years ago, she died by suicide. When I got the news of her death, I was both surprised and not surprised at all. Being alone during a pandemic, just me and my thoughts in that apartment, I started to feel numb. I could not remember feeling joy, even though months before I'd been celebrating my work, had been planning a life, had been able to pick up a collection of poetry, read a single poem, and feel a sense of connection with the world, something meaningful and artful and complex. Now the pandemic had me questioning whether any part of my world had any meaning at all, if there was any point to all of this. I was convinced I'd never see my partner again, I'd never see my family again, that my mother would die in that hospital alone without me there to hold her hand. How could I keep going when I did not have a reason? The truth was that I did not want to die. The truth was that as soon as my partner left, as soon as the work and the planning and the traveling stopped, when there were no more parties or family and friends, as soon as I was alone, I recognized what I had been doing my whole life. I'd spent my 20s and early 30s avoiding the problems. Even though I'd had periods of happiness, even though I'd been productive and high-functioning, I'd somehow managed all that without dealing with any of my mental illness. I had not taken care of myself. I'd spent 15 years avoiding therapy, starting and abandoning it as soon as it got hard. And now the isolation was forcing me to see how I needed to face all the ways I had let my illness get out of control when I knew what I had to do and was fully capable of taking it on. Finally, when I could not take any more sleepless nights, I made an appointment with a therapist. I arrived in the UK in early August, after months of weekly psychotherapy. I was finally able to read and write. I was sleeping without medication. I had committed to getting better and was doing the work. I quarantined for 2 weeks before moving in with my partner. At the end of August, we got married in a small private ceremony in their mother's living room. I never stopped thinking about how fortunate I am, how privileged. I grew up poor. Then that meant that as a teenager, when I first started showing symptoms of major depressive disorder, my family could not afford treatment. It was never an option. During the pandemic, when so many people have lost their jobs, their homes, their health insurance, I have been lucky. Even though I lost most of my income, I've still been able to work from home. I don't have children to care for. I can still afford weekly therapy. I was able to pay for an international flight, leave the U.S. for 6, 7, 8 months at a time. Most women are not this privileged. Living in the U.K. and watching the U.S. from abroad, even temporarily, has given me new perspective. I am grateful for every day, for my health, for my family, friends, and spouse. I'm always conscious of how fortunate I am, and I can finally say I am truly happy. The happiest I have ever been. I try to remember that I may not always be this happy, that depression tries to convince me that there is no point. But there is. I have learned that for me there's a way to keep making art, to keep living. I prioritize my mental health. I stay focused on the things that feel meaningful and purposeful. And sometimes I ask myself, am I alive? And the answer is always, yes, I am alive. And I know it's exactly how I want to be. The author of this article, Hakira Diaz, is the author of Ordinary Girls. This page is entitled For the Record. Do you miss me yet? Donald Trump, former president. In a speech at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Orlando, February 28. 4,800 feet distance, two men descended February 21 when they skied and rappelled from the summit of Yosemite's Half Dome, becoming the first people known to have done so. He would say something beautiful, something inspiring, something that would amplify that little voice inside all of us that tells you you can, that tells you to keep going. Taylor Simone Ledward, accepting a posthumous Golden Globe Award February 28 for her husband, Chadwick Boseman, and his performance in the film Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I now understand that my interactions may have been insensitive or too personal. Andrew Cuomo, New York governor, in a February 28 statement responding to sexual harassment allegations leveled against him by two former employees. 77, weight in pounds of fleece shorn from a ram recently found in rural Australia, a farm sanctuary worker told Reuters, February 23. We are now on track to have enough vaccine supply for every adult in America by the end of May, Joe Biden, U.S. President, in a March 2 speech announcing increased production of COVID-19 vaccines. Can only have been painted by a madman. Edvard Munch, M-U-N-C-H, in an inscription on his 1895 work, The Scream, that's S-C-R-E-A-M, Curators at the National Museum of Norway announced February 22 that the handwriting, previously thought to be graffiti, was the artist's. Good news of the week, Bethany Christian Services, one of the largest religious adoption and foster care agencies in the U.S., announced it would start serving LGBTQ families nationwide March 1. Taking care, COVID-19 worsened the humanitarian crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. A new program supports pregnant people stuck in limbo by Jasmine Aguilera. Remember the cover photo that I described to you in some sense? Well, here she is again. Xiomara plays with her baby in the nursery of the San Juan Apostol Migrant Shelter. The baby's a little girl, I guess, because she's all dressed in various shades of pink. She's got a hot pink little tutu on and little pink socks and little pink shoes. Oh, she is wearing some greenish-colored leggings, but she's got a light pink shirt, a great big bouffant hot pink rose on a headband around her small little head that's covered with very black hair. She's wearing little tiny earrings. Her mom, Xiomara, I guess that's how it's pronounced, X-I-O-M-A-R-A, is dressed in blacks and grays. She's got black shoes, black pants, a grayish-looking sweatshirt. One does not see Jomara's face, only the back of her head, back and side of her head. She's got long, flowing black hair. She's looking directly into the baby's little face, which is seen here in profile, and appears that the little baby with the great big flowery headband is smiling back at her mom. They're in a room that's filled with those port-a-pack cribs. I guess that's what they're called. They're mesh-looking, and they don't quite reach the floor, as if they're a combination crib and playpen. One wall is showing them all lined up next to one another. And then above the cribs or playpens or the combination thereof, there are some decorations on the wall, some stars and little yellow buses and little teddy bear-looking creatures. So they're in a place for little people. This article is part of Time's special report, Women in the Pandemic. And the photographs of the mother and baby are by Meredith Kohut for Time. Xiomara was already having labor pains when she presented herself to the U.S. Border Patrol officials to make a claim for asylum. She had fled gang violence in El Salvador 6 months earlier, working under the table in Mexico to afford bus tickets for her and her three young children to make it to the border. When she finally arrived, 9 months pregnant and feeling contractions, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, offered to take her to a hospital. But she'd heard about the family separations and was worried about losing her kids if she were hospitalized. So instead, she was sent back to the streets of Ciudad Juarez at night, alone with the children and with another on the way. "It was sad and I started to cry," Xiomara, 33, tells Time in Spanish. "I really thought they would let me through to the U.S. Instead," she says, "officials kept telling her that I shouldn't have showed up." It was May 23, the U.S. government's rule, which states that any migrants showing up at the border be immediately turned away to Mexico, even if they wish to make a claim for asylum, an international right, because of the risks posed by COVID-19, was put in place in March. Since then, CBP has conducted more than 444,000 expulsions of this type at the U.S.-Mexico border. After a kind stranger in Juarez told Xiomara the name of a shelter he knew, she took her children, ages 10, 6, and 4, only to find it was full. But it did not matter. In any event, Xiomara and her children would have to quarantine in a hotel for 2 weeks before being allowed into any shelter. An official from the Hotel Flamingo, which has since been dubbed Hotel Filtro, or Filter Hotel, for its reputation with migrants, came to pick her up. There, Leticia Chavarria, a Juarez physician and fierce advocate for migrant women, offered to examine her at no cost. It was the first time Jamara had seen a doctor throughout her pregnancy, but not for lack of trying. A doctor's visit in Mexico would have cost her more than 3,000 Mexican pesos, about $143. She did not have the money. It is impossible to know how many pregnant people have ended up stranded in Mexico as a result of Trump-era immigration policies, including expulsions. The Migrant Protection Protocols, MPP, otherwise known as Remain in Mexico Policy, or metering, which required those planning to claim asylum to take a number and wait in Mexico before making an initial claim. MPP alone has kept more than 71,000 people waiting in Mexico for their asylum claims to be adjudicated in the U.S. since the policy began in January 2019. As of January of this year, more than 29,000 people still have active MPP cases, according to Syracuse University's Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, a research organization. Given how many women have arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border in the past 2 years, it is reasonable to estimate that there have been thousands who were pregnant or became pregnant while they waited to cross into the U.S. Though the MPP agreement grants asylum seekers access to Mexico's health care system, actually using it is difficult. Migrants from across Latin America may not know how to navigate the Mexican health care system, have the right documents with them, or be able to afford care, and face discrimination because of their immigration status. This is a total vulnerability that these women face, Chavarria tells Time in Spanish. They are women, alone with children, and on top of that, migrants, and on top of that, pregnant. Being an asylum-seeking woman can increase the risk of a stillbirth or abortive outcomes, according to German researchers who studied pregnant asylum seekers in South Germany between 2010 and 2016. The physical stress alone can complicate their pregnancies, to say nothing of the emotional stress. Chavarria has encountered women experiencing miscarriages or other dangerous complications without health care. Luckily for Jamara, her chance meeting with Chavarria led to becoming one of the first members of Las Zadas, that's Z-A-D-A-S, short for Embarazadas, meaning pregnant in Spanish, a project launched in June by immigration lawyer Taylor Levy, along with a midwife and several community organizers in Juarez, to try to keep pregnant asylum seekers from falling through the cracks. Las Zadas, the only program of its type along the border, provides free health care, legal advice, products for babies, and pre- and postnatal care like vitamins, menstrual pads, and breast pumps. Some of the women live together at San Juan Apostol, a Juarez shelter for migrant women, while receiving treatment, so they can support and advocate for each other. There's a photograph here on this page. It looks like a sunny place. It's a patio. It is enclosed by a high decorative fence, and there are some rather short pine trees in planters within the patio. A woman is seated cross-legged on the ground. She's dressed casually. She has no shoes on, but she's wearing gray and pink socks, and she's wearing jeans, and she's wearing a camel-colored jacket. She has long blonde hair. And she's apparently addressing a semicircle of youngsters, and one sees only their backs, but there are 2, 4, 6, 8, some girls and some boys, and they're seated facing the woman who is seated cross-legged on the patio. It is psychologist Galarza leading a group therapy session with children living at the San Juan Apostol shelter. And I would guess that the children are between the ages of probably preschool, 4 or 5 year olds, to maybe as old as 9 or 10. Then there's another photo on the facing page. It looks like a chapel setting. It has stained glass windows. It has a very large crucifix in wood with probably a plaster adornment of the Christ. It has another statue off to the side, a baptismal font, a pulpit, steps, three steps leading up to the altar, which appears to be a table draped in a heavy linen cloth. There's a big fan off to the side. There's another statue of the Virgin holding the child. It's on a shelf. The steps and the chancel appear to be in marble. And there are two women mopping the floor, mopping the altar level floor and mopping the sanctuary level floor. And sitting by itself, near the women, sitting by itself on the floor of the altar, there's a baby in a car seat or an infant seat, apparently accompanying somebody's mom. And I shall read the caption to you now. Migrant women mop the sanctuary floors of the Associated San Juan Apostol Evangelical Parish while a baby rests nearby. So the baby doesn't need to help with the cleanup. It's just resting in its carrier. Returning to the text, June 6, just 14 days after Xiomara was turned away from the border, Chavarria helped her to a hospital where she delivered a healthy baby girl. But her journey was not over. Still in limbo, Xiomara and her four children have now been living at San Juan Apostol for 8 months. As COVID-19 began spreading throughout the U.S. in March 2020, immigration courts temporarily shut down, increasing wait times for those under MPP. The Department of Justice's Executive Office for Immigration Review, EOIR, would announce court closures on its website or via Twitter, and many asylum seekers missed the notices. They would show up at ports of entry ready to make their case to a judge, only to find out their court date had been canceled. Beginning at 4 a.m., Levy would stand at the Juarez side of the Paso del Norte International Bridge, connecting Juarez to El Paso, Texas, several times a week to meet those asylum seekers and break the news. There were a lot of women coming who were visibly pregnant, just devastated by the fact that the courts had been canceled, Levy says. Of course, that could be Levy or Levi. I'm pronouncing it Levy, L-E-V-Y. It was during those cold, dark mornings where I started thinking about creating this project. Some of the women told Levy they'd never seen a doctor, did not know where they'd give birth, and that they'd been turned away from hospitals. It was really kind of scrappy from the beginning, Levy says, of Las Azadas early days. Levy gave free legal advice, while midwife Anna White provided prenatal care. If a woman needed shelter, she'd be referred to San Juan Apostol, where coordinator Karina Braceda could assist her. There, Chavarria and Patricia Galarza, a Juarez psychologist, offered free physical and mental health care. My team's basically on call 24/7, Braceda says. That's B-R-E-C-E-D-A. There's a lot of peace, P-E-A-C-E, and a lot of healing with the work they're doing. The situation here in the city of Juarez, it's sometimes a very unsafe place, and women go through crises. In Mexico, asylum seekers are often victims of kidnapping, robbery, rape, and extortion. Human Rights First, an advocacy organization, has documented more than 1,500 public claims of violence against asylum seekers under MPP. Jomara, who says she fled gang members in El Salvador and is a survivor of sexual assault, says giving birth triggered the difficult traumas she was grappling with. I felt very strange. I'd look at my daughter, and it was almost like I didn't want her, Jomara says, citing a common symptom of postpartum depression. Therapy at San Juan Apostol helped her, she says, and 4 months after the baby was born, I was able to be affectionate with her. The support of the other women in the program can be just as valuable. Isa, 32, an asylum seeker from Honduras, first found refuge with her young son at a shelter, housing roughly 1,300 people in Juarez. But food was scarce, she says, and overcrowding kept her on constant alert. 7 months ago, Isa was brought to live at San Juan Apostol, and 3 months later, she gave birth to a healthy baby girl. The women gathered around, ooing and aahing over the baby and celebrating her birth. Each day they're up at 6 a.m., feeding the babies and rotating shifts of laundry, cooking, and washing dishes while the children play together. If one feels overwhelmed, others serve as a buttress, helping her with child care and breastfeeding, and sometimes even stepping in as wet nurses. They often break out in song. Oh, dear, I'm going to try this. El color de tus ojos, the color of your eyes, is one of Isa's favorites. All told, Las Azadas has supported about 120 women and helped bring an estimated 68 babies safely into the world. Despite the care and community, Isa says the wait in Mexico has made her anxious. February 19, the Biden administration began processing some asylum seekers in Tijuana into the U.S., the first step in unraveling MPP. Slowly, an estimated 25,000 asylum seekers, including Isa, will be able to enter the country. Now that we know we're so close, we feel even more desperate, says Isa in Spanish. We really don't know how much longer we'll have to be here. She hopes to reunite with a friend in New York who has a safe place for her to stay while her asylum case is decided. Her ultimate goal is to afford a good education for her children. I want them to have a future, she says, any future they want, and security as well. Jomara's case is more complicated. While MPP is winding down, expulsions continue at the border, with no clear answer from the government whether these migrants will have a second chance to apply for asylum. She wonders aloud if participating in this interview might help her chances. First and foremost, all I want is safety for myself and my children. I have faith in God that things will get better, Jomara says. That's all I can do. There's one more photo here in this article. It's a kitchen. It's a big commercial kitchen with lots of big containers, stainless steel containers, several women standing around the counters with the containers. One young woman in the foreground, dressed all in black, her hair pulled back, it's dark brown. She's looking at one of the great big pots. I think it's on the stove in this case. She has very large goldish filigree earrings. Shelter coordinator Braceda cooks soup with migrant women in the kitchen. Here's the border crisis by the numbers, 29,000 asylum seekers currently waiting to enter the U.S. from Mexico under MPP, 444,000 number of expulsions that have taken place at the U.S.-Mexico border due to COVID-19 restrictions, 1,500 public claims of violence against asylum seekers under MPP, 68 babies born to mothers in the Las Azadas program at the U.S.-Mexico border. Politics. Democrats cannot keep all their promises in the COVID-19 relief bill. This is by Alana Abramson. The Democrats' unified control of Washington puts them within striking distance of passing President Biden's coronavirus relief package, sending 1,400 checks to lower and middle-income Americans, extending federal unemployment insurance until August 29, and allotting nearly $130 billion to reopen K-12 schools, but it's also notable what almost certainly will not end up in the final bill, a $15 minimum wage increase and a repeal of two tax breaks implemented under last year's CARES Act that primarily benefited billionaires and millionaires. Now, there's already been action taken on this, as I understand it, so I'm skipping to the last paragraph for a few additional details. Mind the gap. Tax increases are still on the table for a subsequent recovery package later this year. March 1, Senator Elizabeth Warren introduced a proposal for a wealth tax. Even with the party's newfound power to address the ever-widening wealth gap, it still seems to be much easier for corporations and high-net-worth individuals to score 7 or even 8-figure tax breaks than for workers to get a minimum wage increase. That is a problem the party will have to grapple with long after Biden signs his American Rescue Plan. Here's a photo. It is political, but it's unrelated to the last segment of the article that I read. It is a room. It almost looks like a courtroom or a wood-paneled auditorium. It has lots of tall-backed chairs. They're yellow, and the woodwork is a dark, rich, reddish-brown. And most of the chairs are occupied by individuals looking as if they're dressed in light blue sheets. Over their heads and around their bodies, or at least around a major part of their torsos. There are brown faces peering out from beneath these sheet-looking apparatuses. Most of the faces are wearing masks, either white or the light blue, to coordinate with the rest of the costume. And the room must contain hundreds because there are several rows with several people in each row. There are also additional individuals, it looks like mostly men, standing around the perimeter of the room. The caption reads, "Free again." 4 days after they were abducted by unidentified gunmen from a boarding school in Nigeria's Zamfara state, 279 schoolgirls, some pictured above at a government building, were released March 2. School kidnappings are often undertaken by jihadist and criminal groups in the region as a way to extort ransoms. The state government has, however, denied paying a ransom for the girls, a controversial practice in Nigeria, as many say it fuels further criminality. From the news ticker, three short items. U.S. airstrike targets militia groups in Syria. February 25, President Joe Biden authorized an airstrike in eastern Syria, the first such military action of his administration. The strike was aimed at infrastructure used by Iran-backed militia groups involved in a February attack against U.S. coalition forces in Iraq, according to a letter Biden sent to Congress 2 days later. Power co-op bankrupt after Texas storm. Brazos Electric Power Cooperative, Texas' largest and oldest electric power company, filed for bankruptcy protection March 1, citing a $2.1 billion bill it received from the state's grid operator after a historic winter storm in mid-February. Polish court acquits LGBTQ activists. In the culmination of a case widely seen as a test of freedoms of speech, a Polish court acquitted three LGBTQ activists March 2 after they produced and distributed images of a religious icon with a rainbow flag. They'd been accused of desecration and offending religious feelings. LGBTQ rights groups called the ruling a breakthrough. More news ticker, three more items. Hong Kong charges 47 under new law. In the most forceful use yet of Hong Kong's new and wide-ranging National Security Law, authorities charged 47 pro-democracy figures February 28 with conspiracy to commit subversion, carrying a potential sentence of life imprisonment. The defendants include activist Joshua Wong and former law professor Benny Tai, or Tay, T-A-I. 10 arrested in Barcelona protests. 10 people were arrested in Barcelona February 27 during protests over the arrest and conviction of a rapper for glorifying terrorism and insulting royalty in his lyrics. Pablo Hasél's arrest February 16 has since sparked sometimes violent protests in Barcelona and Madrid, and a debate over freedom of expression. Playtime, Driving Diversity, by Madeline Carlyle. Hasbro announced February 25 it will drop Mr. and Mrs. titles from an upcoming Potato Head playset, so everyone can feel welcome in the Potato Head world. Here, more toys updated for inclusion and representation. Changing Tones. Crayola launched its Colors of the World crayon box set in May 2020, releasing new colors meant to reflect over 40 skin tones from around the world. The line has since expanded to pencils and markers. A Doll for All. Mattel, the maker of Barbie, launched its first line of gender-neutral dolls in 2019. A company spokesperson said it was time for a line free of labels, and that Mattel hoped the new toys would help kids freely express themselves. Fighting Words. After a six-year-old girl wrote to ask why none of its iconic green army soldiers were female, BMC Toys decided to launch its first line of plastic army women, available in four military poses, December 2020. Good question. Why isn't the U.S. sanctioning Mohammed bin Salman? By Kimberly Dozier and W.J. Hennigan. In newly declassified detail, the world can now read why the CIA believes Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman dispatched the 15-man hit squad that killed and dismembered Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. I'll spell that K-H-A-S-H-O-G-G-I. MBS, as the prince is known, viewed Khashoggi as a threat to the kingdom, the report asserts, and broadly supported using violent measures if necessary to silence him. The plot, which saw Khashoggi lured to his death at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, turned MBS from a figure many hoped would modernize Saudi Arabia into an international pariah. But public shaming is where President Joe Biden's campaign pledged to hold MBS, who denies ordering Khashoggi's murder, accountable, appears to end. February 26, his administration announced new sanctions and travel restrictions for dozens of MBS's alleged henchmen, but punishment of the 35-year-old de facto ruler is limited to bruising his ego. U.S. officials say they won't be inviting him to visit anytime soon, and Biden is not taking his calls, communicating instead with his father, 85-year-old King Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud. MBS will have to make do with conversing with the Pentagon chief. The slap on the wrist sparked immediate criticism in Washington from lawmakers and human rights activists who want to see MBS charged or even somehow ousted from power for the killing. But the Biden administration has evidently calculated it has too much at stake to alienate Riyadh. State Department spokesman Ned Price described the diplomatic slights not as a rupture, but as a recalibration. Saudi Arabia is central to ongoing U.S. efforts to offset Iran's expansionist ambitions in the Middle East, to continue to strengthen ties between Israel and the Arab world, and to help Washington fight the violent extremism Riyadh's fundamentalist clerics have been accused of helping foster. The nation hosts key U.S. military and intelligence posts and buys billions in U.S. military equipment, even after a recent Biden ban on offensive weapon sales to the country to stop MBS's increasingly bloody campaign in Yemen. Militarily speaking, we have obligations there in Saudi Arabia, and we're going to continue to meet those, Pentagon spokesman John Kirby told reporters. Indeed, Saudi news agencies reported that Saudi and U.S. troops began a joint training exercise just 2 days after the Khashoggi report's release. Biden officials hope the diplomatic snubs are just enough to distinguish Biden from Donald Trump's coddling of the kingdom and to keep MBS from lashing out at other journalists and dissidents. Saudi analyst Ali Shihabi says the rising royal does feel insulted and could turn to Beijing both to hedge his bets and to salve his battered pride if he continues to come under attack from Washington. But if this is put behind us, he will forget about it, Shihabi says. Biden's team appears to have calculated that most Americans, coping with COVID-19's chaos at home, have already done just that. Time off music. Can the Grammys survive a new music era? By Andrew R. Chow. This will undoubtedly be abridged for time purposes. Complaints about the Grammys are about as old as the Grammys themselves. Over the decades, Little Richard, Sinead O'Connor, Frank Ocean, and many others have ripped the award show for being self-serving and for being exclusionary, especially to women and artists of color. But these criticisms have reached a fever pitch over the past 2 years. Executives turned defectors have claimed widespread internal corruption. Music stars have questioned the show's voting processes, and streaming platforms have kickstarted their own rival shows to undercut the Grammys' unique prestige. What once was the highest form of recognition may no longer matter to the artists that exist now and the ones that come after, Drake wrote in an Instagram story in November. The Recording Academy hopes to salvage some of its reputation in this year's ceremony, which arrives March 14, and features nominations for Beyoncé, Taylor Swift, and Dua Lipa. But the Academy's long-entrenched structural issues, compounded by fundamental shifts in the music industry at large, may make its bid to regain primacy an uphill battle. For years, public derision has followed each instance of white middle-brow acts triumphing over culture-defining black art at the Grammys. See, Macklemore winning over Kendrick Lamar, Beck over Beyoncé. In January 2020, former Recording Academy President Deborah Dugan threw another devastating haymaker when she filed a formal complaint accusing its voting body of being a boys' club, rife with corruption and favoritism via secret committees. She also accused high-ranking members of sexual misconduct and financial irregularities. Dugan's claims were all that other industry power players needed to pile on to the organization. When the 2021 nominees were announced in November, Halsey, Nicki Minaj, Drake, and The Weeknd all took to Twitter angrily, with Halsey alleging nominations were often predicated on giving bribes that can be just ambiguous enough to pass as not bribes. Dugan's complaint alleged that high-ranking board members can push nominations to artists with whom they have relationships. These attacks serve as a double blow. Not only did they normalize the idea that Grammy victories are not truly earned, but they also exacerbated a trend of music's biggest stars defecting from the ceremony. Last March, Spotify recognized a global shift when it kickstarted its own award show in Mexico, paying tribute to the fast-rising icons of Latin America like Bad Bunny and Karol G. And in December, The Apple Music Awards planted a flag for a younger generation, featuring glossy performances from Megan Thee Stallion, Lil Baby, and Roddy Ricch. This competition further dilutes the Grammys' authority in a year in which awards shows as a whole are cratering, in part because of COVID-19. The Emmys, Billboard Music Awards, and CMA Awards all hit all-time ratings lows. Billboard Music Awards, CMA Awards, and Emmys. The Grammys themselves hit a 12-year low last January. The one artist most equipped to buoy the ceremonies this year might be The Weeknd. After delivering an eye-popping Super Bowl performance last month, the singer saw an enormous streaming bonanza of his music, but he wasn't nominated for a single Grammy this year, so he won't be showing up for the ceremonies. "I have 3 Grammys," the artist told Billboard, "which mean nothing to me now." We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.